maybe I just point something little out. Another way in which something happened that you might not have noticed, but it's worth noticing happening, which is when I explain these fairly literal concepts of perspective, I was always talking about spatial features of things. But already in one, which seemed very heuristic to you, I don't just have something that is round can appear elliptical, but I also say, if I look at something in one light, it'll appear green, in another blue. So I don't just have spatial properties, I have color properties of objects. And it's worth mentioning because in the Renaissance, people actually argued about whether the topic of color, the painter's representation of color, or in that sense, light, belonged in a treatise on perspective. Here's an argument that it does belong in a treatise on perspective. As you vary your position, shadow and light changes, and that changes appearances that have to do with hue and shade of color. So the representation of color has to do with the variation of the position of the observer, just like the variation of shape, apparent shape. So that's an argument in favor of putting it. But an argument against putting it was, well, the way you do perspective is you fix a viewpoint, and then you can lay out a grid for how things look from that position. With the variation of color, it's only by trying to move around that there's anything to paint that is the variation. And the second thing is that it's not clear how you formulate laws for that. What are the laws? I can give you very precise laws, like as Leibniz and Descartes were already very precise. You can write them down as equations for how shape varies with apparent shape varies with color. But with apparent shape varies with position. But with color, it's much harder. It's one reason it took a lot longer to get color film than black and white film. It's a real mess how color looks. If you put something red up against something black, that changes the shade that the red towards the black has. If you move the black over a bit, it changes it, and so forth. It's not just position. There's all kinds of issues about relative juxtaposition, relative to observer, that make a difference. So getting good color film, the guy who invented Polaroid film, Edwin Land, he discovered all sorts of principles that seem completely counterintuitive to any natural way of developing laws. And even now, they're not so much laws as just lots of ad hoc adjustments to come up with how to generate something that yields apparent color. So that's an argument for saying in the Renaissance, color is not part of the science of perspective. I don't care what you say. All I'm trying to bring out is now we find it perfectly natural to read one and think, sure, as our perspective changes, the color of the thing might change. But that's already a further extension of the features of objects, this is going back to your question already a little bit, that are relevant in talking about perspective. Now, once we've made that step, you might ask, so which features count as ones that depend on perspective, and which ones don't? We know that the spatial ones count. We know that the color ones count, and so on. But then, that's one question we have to decide. Very early on, the tendency was to keep it to, here's a further feature of the metaphor, which is held stable, at least perceptual features of the object. That is, features that the object has in virtue just of how it looks. So, for instance, how it sounds, or how it smells. That wouldn't matter if all that matters is how it looks. But, so that would be one way to go. Perspective just has to do with visual features, perceptually visual features. That'd be one place to draw the line. Another place to draw the line is say all perceptual features. How it looks, how it sounds, how it smells. But only perceptual features. So, for example, the fact that Richard's weight is divisible by 4 is not a relevant feature of what varies when my perspective, when Richard varies. So just perceptual features. That'd be another step. When we get to stage 1 perspectivism, I call primary quality realism. Both those steps have been taken. Those are both pretty big steps. It's worth noticing. So we're not, it's not just, there's a concept of perspective, there's something that it is to be a perspectivist. Various decisions have been made about how to extend the concept. So we're extending it beyond the spatial features to visual features, and not just color, but all visual features, and beyond the visual features to all perceptual features. Those are several dramatic extensions of the concept of perspective from what, for lack of a better way of talking, I'll call the original concept. Having done all of that, one says, and now one will stop. All that, and only that, is what is a function of our perspective. That's what we want to understand. That's one feature of stage one perspectivism. But there's another very important feature of stage one perspectivism and subsequent perspectivisms that comes with perspectivism becoming not a truistic way of employing metaphor, but a philosophical position. And that is a distinction between the idea that some ways in which it's appear, some aspects of the thing. So we've gathered together all these aspects of the things. But then we're going to further say, some aspects of the things are merely due to our perspective. And other aspects of the things are not. They reflect something about the nature of the things themselves. So, in stage one perspectivism, you get a distinction between primary qualities and secondary qualities. And I think it's an important fact about the early modern period when you get this kind of view, that people argue about where to draw the line. It's not obvious where to draw the line. We can talk about that in a minute if you want. But right now, I'm not so much concerned with where you draw the line as that you're drawing such a line. So what this line reflects is the idea that some qualities of things work just the way they did with the original concept of perspective. Like shape, for instance. So if I look at the thing from here, it appears elliptical. If I look at it from here, it appears round. It really has a shape. Shape is almost always taken to be one of the primary qualities. It really does have a shape. But apparent shape is related to real shape by principles of perspective, and we have to correct for distortion. But there is such a thing as correcting for distortion and getting the real shape. And there is such a thing as a non-distorting perspective. We can sometimes have a perspective on things that are frontally that gives us a good view of its real shape. So, the relationship between perspective and object still retains the logic of 1 through 5. In 1 through 5 in item 5. but for other qualities, secondary qualities, like color, there isn't any way of varying our position we now hold, if we're in stage 1 perspective, in which we can get a view of its real color. We can't correct for the distortion in color to get the real color. We now hold the color is, and now we have to add a word that wasn't there in the statement of 8, but we can add. Color is merely perspectively dependent. It's not the character of the appearance of the quality that's merely perspective dependent now. It's the quality itself, color, which is thought to be entirely contributed by our perspective. Things have shapes, they don't have colors. That's what Galileo and Kepler, following them, Newton, Locke, and so forth, held. So, and Berkeley was very good at pointing out various problems with this. So That means that with respect to the first sorts of qualities, we have all five features. We can correct for distortion, etc., etc., etc. With respect to the other sorts of qualities, we're starting to get some of the features that are summed up in seven. That is, there is no correcting for distortion. Our perspective involved is irreducibly distorted in the way in which it yields a view of objects in this respect, namely as color. So what happens now in our perspectivism, which we didn't have before, but starts when perspectivism becomes a philosophical position, with stage one, is the idea of two kinds of perspectival features. Those which can be corrected for, and we need to understand how they vary, systematically with respect to the object. We remain Leibnizian about those, if you will. And we become, as it were, comparatively, as it were, supposedly Nietzschean, or at least if you have Dante's Nietzschean, about these qualities, and we say they are merely a function of the perspective. So you've got two layers of perspective now. So one of the things that's complicated is that the logic of the metaphor of perspective, already at stage one, is working two ways at once. Part of the time, we're taking perspective to analogize to the aspect of the quality which can be corrected for, elliptical round. Earlier, also red-blue. In other cases, within the same view, we're taking the quality itself to be the thing that's analogous to elliptical or round. So it's not this color is to round as that color is to elliptical. It's color itself is to elliptical as not having color at all is to round. That is, this very feature of the quality itself is a kind of distortion our perspective introduces. Once you have this step with stage one perspectivism, what I'm trying to bring out is the metaphor is already becoming quite unstable. We're taking the metaphor of perspective and we're using some of its features to analogize to some things and other of its features to analogize to other things at the same time. We really have two metaphors functioning at the same time in a single position. So it's already a possibility of things getting quite complicated. And then in the early modern philosophers, they argued about how to draw this line. So one view was, whatever you needed to do science, in a scientific view of the world, the qualities that you had to impute to the object in order to do science were the primary qualities of the object. So if you're somebody like Locke, you say, not only shape, but for instance, solidity is a primary quality of objects. Because we need to do mechanics. Mechanics involves the idea this ball hits that ball moves. So, solidity. Other people thought, no, it's kind of hard to do a mathematics of solidity. You can do mathematics of shape. What science is really the mathematizable features of the world. And solidity seems to be a tactile quality. It seems to be a perceptual quality like smell and touch and taste. And so that should be one of the primary qualities. That should be over here with smell and color and taste and so on. So you can already see that once you try to draw this kind of line, there's going to be some instability about which side you should move things to. And so then you had people like Descartes saying, well, matter is a purely geometric concept. And then other people saying, well, matter is a completely geometric concept. And then this isn't a concept of a thing that's in the world. So we need to put more in there in order to give flesh to it. So it's a concept of how things are independent of our concepts. But then I realize, oh, you put that in, you start to get the secondary qualities in there. So already this thing that's supposed to be a line is subject to quite a bit of trouble. It's a question of how to do this in a non-arbitrary way, if you want to employ the metaphor. And one of the things that leads to is a natural inclination to think, we haven't employed the metaphor in the right way to begin with. We're going to rethink this metaphor. We want to use perspective as a metaphor for distinguishing what's intrinsic and what's perspectively dependent. We need to give a different kind of answer to your question. Now, I have an answer that talks about perceptible qualities of things, in which are primary and which are secondary, but a completely different kind of answer. That answer says that what we want the analogy for is not just for our perceptual apprehension of things, but our conceptual comprehension of things. Our perspective is how the thing presents itself to us, which is a function as much of how we think about the thing as just some pure properties that hit our senses. So, we get stage two. In stage two, we say, no, there are two kinds of concepts. I don't know what you want to call these. There's different words we could use. But let's just use the words objective or really objective concepts. Oops, what happened? Concepts, objective concepts, and perspective dependent concepts. So, a lot of concepts we use have to do with us and our particular way of relating to things. That something's tasty, that something's a chair. These are very anthropomorphic concepts. It has to do with our needs and shapes and bodies. We want to describe the world as it is in itself. We don't want to use concepts like that. We want to use concepts that, in a sense, any being that's just trying to get the world right, apart from their particular perspective on the world, would use. So now, first thing you notice is how the metaphor of perspective has been extended even further. Now, not just features of our perception of the world, the features of our conception belong to a perspective. And this too, I think, is now, it's a huge extension of the concept of its philosophical metaphor, well beyond what it meant in the early modern period. But I also think it's just part of the dictionary definition of the word. I mean, go into the bookstore and you'll find all kinds of books called things like Perspectives on French Economic History, or Contemporary Perspectives in Modern Linguistics, and so forth. That isn't about whether linguistics looks green or blue to different people. Those are perspectives clearly understood as something like different ways of thinking about X. So it's part of how the concept has been extended now, that what was once a metaphor is almost a dead metaphor, even happened the last couple hundred years, which is that a perspective is now a metaphor for what thinking. And if we want to take our way of thinking as part of the structure of a concept of perspective that has the five features that it's supposed to have in number five here, page one of the handout, if we want to hold those two things together, then we need to be able to work from concepts that are relatively distorted to ones that we can correct for, that are concepts that capture how things are. We want to combine, as it were, the logic of those five features with the statement of number eight, which gives us an answer to your question. The concepts now to be the things that capture the world. What's the world? The world is the thing that's described by these non-perspective dependent concepts. That's a new answer to your question, not the previous answer to your question. The previous answer to your question was, the world is the feature that the world looks to have that are not features that are merely function of our perspective that introduce those appearances. So the first is the real appearances versus the merely apparent appearances. It's a perceptual answer of what yields the world. This is a conceptual answer for what, how to answer the question, what is the world? Now, again, there's a desire to draw a line here. But again, notice there are a lot of different ways to draw this line. And Nietzsche, throughout his work, is incredibly interested in this line, the one that starts at this point, once the concept of perspective has been inflected this far. And so one of the things Nietzsche's interested in is how very different views. Views in history, philosophy, people might have taken to be very different, all have this structure. I think the three he's particularly interested in this respect are Platonism, Christianity, modern science, or what we might call the metaphysics of modern science. Modern meaning, modern from Nietzsche's point of view, so 18th, 19th century. All three of these views, Nietzsche, I think, thinks, has something like this structure. That there's a way in which the world first presents itself to us, which involves ways of thinking which need to be purified. And there is a discipline of purification at which we arrive at the concepts which capture how things are. For Plato, this has to do with so Plato's metaphor of the cave is a crucial moment for this in Nietzsche, but what Nietzsche is really interested in is Platonism, which he brings up a little later. Christianity, or as he likes to say sometimes, Platonism for the masses, gives a much more theological gloss to what these concepts are. The world, one of the things Nietzsche's interest in is how this generates a distinction between what he calls the apparent world and the true world. Of course, we had that before, right? I mean, with the first answer to the question before the break, we had apparent world and true world. Apparent world is colored, the true world is spatial. But now, these worlds are more radically disjoint. The spatial world, the true world, was a world that presented itself in appearances at stage one. It's just that not everything that presented itself in appearances at stage one was a true feature of the world. At stage two, the apparent world itself, everything as it initially appears, is all, as it were, part of life in the cave. The true world has to come from peeling off almost all aspects of appearances. So, objects aren't really spatial. You know, if spatial means a certain kind of geometrical appearance, they're subject to certain sorts of equations. That's the correct description of it. F equals ma. You know, that's the kind of structure objects have in modern science. So, we could talk more about this again, but I'm going to leave it for now. It'll come back next week. There are different kinds of stage two perspectivism. But notice still here in stage two perspectivism, we have the same instability. There are some concepts which describe how the world is, and which we can arrive at. We can sift through our concepts and get ones that are less and less perspectively dependent. And there are others, they're just inherently misleading. But as we arrive at this sort of view, it's very hard now, again, to draw this line. Which concepts are the concepts that reflect how things really are? And it's very natural to start to feel a pressure once you've gone this far down the dialectic of perspectivism to think, well, any concept is a concept that humans have created for certain purposes. So it involves carving things up this way rather than that way. We'll see Nietzsche talking about this more in a moment. So concepts themselves always involve, it seems, some kind of departure from how things are to a particular way of carving them up. So in that sense, any concept is itself a function of our perspective. So once you try to draw this line and use the metaphor of perspective in this way, so that's a metaphor that's supposed to divide the class of concepts into the ones that are like the elliptical view and the ones that are like the frontal view of the object, using a metaphor that way. It's very hard to keep yourself from sliding so that it doesn't seem like all of the concepts are themselves part of the perspective, given how the logic of the concept of perspective is functioning in the metaphor. That was very fast. Let's do it a little more slowly in my article. But I'm trying to get to a certain point today, so I'll just keep going. If that happens, if you start feeling that way, as the early Nietzsche surely does, then you become early Nietzsche. And to become early Nietzsche, what happens is you slide, you just keep sliding into stage three. Perspective. Which I also call your handout pseudo-conscientism. Because this is what many people think Kant's view was. And it's also what early Nietzsche thought Kant's view was. And he thought, early Nietzsche thought of himself as belonging to the, or subscribing to the Kantian philosophy. I call it pseudo-Kantianism simply to withhold endorsement from such a reading of Kant. If you're interested in why, there's a seminar on Wednesdays for you. But just leave it at that. So this is the view. If you feel that it looks like concepts themselves are always going to be products of our perspective, and you want to sort between what belongs to our perspective and what doesn't, with that problem about the concepts, then it looks like what's going to happen is your true world, apparent world distinction, it's going to go like this. Our concepts, our ways of thinking, and for that matter, our percepts too. Everything that reflects a contribution of human subjectivity. That's the apparent world. That's the true world. That's where you wind up, sliding along the dialectic. This is stage three. It looks like you have to say, well, you're trying to hold on to some of, you're trying to hold on to these five features. You're starting to lose some of them. A perspective is something that can be freely altered. Well, yeah, we can change these concepts for those concepts. So in that sense, we can still freely alter it. But it's always, in this other sense, ours. So in the one sense, it's like the ones you can correct for. But it has this instability that it's like the secondary qualities now, in the sense that as a set, there's something wrong with them. You see how that instability is really starting to poison things now. It affords a view of the object. Well, okay, if we want to keep that feature that our perspective affords a view of the object, then we need this X. So we say X, that's the object that it affords a view of, which these different things are all views of. We say X because we can't say anything else about it. We don't want to say nothing, so we're going to put X. But we can't say more, because that would be to go beyond our perspective. It has a specified location and a matrix of alternative perspectives. Well, this logical feature is, as it were, starting to crumble. Specifiable? I don't know about specifiable. What we know is it is that which our concepts and percepts are concepts of and percepts of. That's all we can say. And whichever concepts or percepts we choose, we say the same thing about X. It's a lot less interesting than it was in the great old days of perspective, when you had something different to say about each entry. But, you know, still it's locking things in a little bit. It's that common object. The thing that's really cave, they set these things reverse, and they cave in reverse order. And number five is the first one. They completely cave now at stage three. What happened with stage one and stage two is that these five features cave for some features of the world, but not others. For some of our ways of thinking, but not others that we took for granted before. But now, at stage three, feature five caves completely. That is, that they furnish a true estimation of the object itself. Looks like there's no sorting through these for the one that tells us how X is. That's the one, the concepts that are better than the other concepts. We have reasons to prefer these. But anything like a frontal view of X is no longer available. X is the object considered apart from our perspectives, and that we cannot have. And as I said, this is often thought to be a Kantian claim. I have a quotation from Kant suggesting that it's exactly a misreading of Kant that Kant's concerned with. In Article 13, but I think I'll skip that for now. We'll discuss that on Wednesday, if you like. So what happens if you get into this position is that you start thinking that what it is to be a perspectivist is to realize how our ways of thinking belong to our perspective. So instead of this point of view, and this point of view, and this point of view all being different perspectives, or color and shape, stage one belong to different perspectives, or these concepts rather than those concepts belong to different perspectives, all our ways of thinking and proceeding, all part of one perspective. The thing that's being contrasted with is now something we cannot occupy. So the metaphor, what's being folded into the metaphor of a perspective, which it's supposed to stand for, is more and more. We started with very little, and we kept adding stuff. So now we've folded just about everything into the thing that perspective is supposed to be a metaphor, our perspective, all of the stuff. Belongs to our perspective. But you can see that there was a natural pressure that way once we started losing control of the metaphor. But we still want to hold on to some of the logical structure of the concept that we have in 1 through 5 on the first page. So we need the X, which this is a perspective on, for it to still remain, to preserve that much contact with the original concept. And what we have in early Nietzsche is an attempt to occupy that position, as we'll see in a moment. But I'll just mention quickly that what very naturally happens, and what happens to middle period Nietzsche, and what happens in the view that's most often associated with Nietzsche's name, and called perspectivism, is stage four. It's very natural to start thinking. So there's this X. We can't say anything about the X. The X is the world as it is in itself. But the idea of as in itself, that presupposes some determination, which presupposes a concept, which we're not allowed to use. And we're saying it's an object instead of a concept. And Nietzsche says things like, well, the distinction between object and concept itself is an anthropomorphic distinction. It has to do with our ways of thinking. So, you know, even if we're thinking the object is at least named, the X is naming an object, that already imports our concepts of name and object, and implicitly concept. And so, damn it, these anthropomorphic concepts are coming in over here. So, you start thinking, this is something we cannot say anything about. It is empty. So, stage four. Haven't gone far enough. What we have to say is, this is how things work. But this is now an incredibly paradoxical position. We're employing concepts over here, perspective and percept and so forth, that originally had the kind of content they did through their participating in a contrast with the things that were on this side. But we've erased everything that was on this side. So now we're really fundamentally changing the concept of the perspective and the way you see at the end of the Dante quotation. We start saying things like, well, we have our perspectives, but it's a mistake to think that there's something these perspectives are perspectives on. And we have our perspective, but we can't talk about the object that is common across it. So we start really peeling off the other features of the concept we originally had on the first five features. And once we've done this, we wind up with a concept of perspective, if that's what it is, a concept, which has the five features I mentioned. I think it was in 7, I have that one, the post-Nietzschean ones. So this will, so we'll be interested, so this is sort of what I'm going to call stage four perspectivism. The attempt to, as it were, hang on to perspective as a philosophical metaphor, while completely giving up on the idea that we can achieve any view of the world that is not inherently distorted by our perspective. So before, we only had perspectives that we corrected for. Then we introduced two layers of perspective, the ones we could correct for and the ones we couldn't. And what happens by stage four is that infection has reached a point where we only have the second sort. We only have the sort of perspective we can't correct for, and we've lost anything through which we can achieve a genuine correction back to anything you could call a true estimation of the essence of things, to quote Nietzsche. So that's a very quick sketch of the dialectic. Now let's just look at some early Nietzsche for a few minutes.
Jim?
Yep?
Could you please repeat this bit on this conversation between the stage four person and the stage three person? The stage three person has the idea of the way the world is in itself.
We can't know anything about it, but there is such a way.
And the stage four says we can make no sense of this idea, while stage three person says, well, it may be impossible to express this in a coherent way, but I can make sense of it. So what does it mean to make no sense?
Stage three person tends to, a famous formulation taken from Kant, but I think completely changing its meaning, so it fits into the logic of stage three, is to say something like, we cannot know, but we can think it.
Yes.
And indeed, we must think it, because it's a condition of knowledge that knowledge have an object, and it's a condition and so forth. If you'll notice in my statement of stage four, my statement of stage four doesn't become stage four, really, until the last sentence. Most of my statement of stage four, this is on item 14 in the handout. There's all kinds of tricks in this handout we have time to fully explore. But I warn you, there's various traps in mind in it. The statement of stage four, if you leave out the very end, actually doesn't express anything more than a rejection of stage three. It's dissatisfied with stage three. And in particular, with the vacuity of this incredibly deflated concept of an object, a mere X. But it doesn't involve a turn forward into stage four until the end, when we express what it is we should conclude from this dissatisfaction with stage three by saying, therefore, our so-called knowledge of the world is really never of something independent, but consists of nothing more than our possible perspectives themselves and nothing beyond these. That point has become a statement of stage four. When it doesn't just say, there's something wrong with this idea, but it says, okay, given that there's something wrong with this idea and I don't like it, the way to improve on the diagram is just to erase this half, but to try to keep that half. That's when it becomes stage four. But everything you read before that, the idea that, well, this idea of an X, which we need to be able to say something about, but which we're also saying we can't say something about, and which we're actually saying more about than we think we are, while saying that we're not saying anything about it, is a bad idea. That would be a reason maybe to back up to stage 3-2-1 and see how you got into this mess, rather than heading to stage 4. It's only at the end that we push ourselves into stage 4 by saying, okay, here's the solution. We keep the dialectic, we keep the metaphor, but this is causing trouble, so we erase it, and we just keep this half. The way we use the metaphor is we use it the way we wanted to express what it analogized to in this half, while getting rid of what used to be a structurally essential part of the analogy, namely that the perspective is a perspective on something, that you can correct for them, that there are several of them, that you can alter them, and so on.
So this is this idea of the word when lost.
I think Wordy is by and large a stage four perspective.
Yeah.
And Wordy is one of the people that has helped popularize that reading of Nietzsche, as we'll see, not without some textual basis in middle period Nietzsche, but I don't think that's Nietzsche's last or most interesting word about this.
Isn't your description of stage three, apart from the last sentence of stage three, combinable with the last sentence of stage four?
It's a little bit like the question before the break. It all depends how you understand it, but already, way before the last sentence, we have the very idea of our experience of the world presupposes the further idea that there is a way the world is in itself, apart from any perspectival view of it. So we want something which is a way the world is, which suggests a determinate character. It suggests it indeterminately. It doesn't determine what that determinate character is, but it specifies that there is a determinate character, apart from any conceptual determination we may or can't make. And that's already what stage four is objecting to. So I think the problem with stage three, it comes at that moment. It comes earlier. But it comes quietly enough you might not notice. It becomes louder as we go on. I tried to write each of these stages so as you first read them, you think, you're not, and it sounds kind of sensible. And then you get to the end, and you go, oh, this is a chunk of philosophy. But, you know, question about exactly how you got there. But so I think actually a strict stage four is, and I imagine Rorty reading this, and Rorty, whose sensitivities are extremely well tuned to this kind of issue, will start bristling with those first italicized words. And that's why italicized. Rorty will even bristle with the words I italicized before that, appearances. And as soon as Rorty hears appearances, or world for that matter, he starts getting nervous. He thinks he's being sold philosophy. Poor Dick Rorty has, you know, at this point gotten so stuck, I think, at the end of this dialectic that he could even read, I think, the first thing on the first page and start worrying whether he's being sold appearance, reality, or something of some heavy sort. But so, yeah, I think the trouble starts in the lower end. That's the short answer. I'm going to quickly, I'm sort of running out of time, but I'm just going to quickly get Nietzsche onto the page. Maybe let's just go back to the Dante quote for a moment. I'm not going to read it through or take the time. But I think what you'll notice in the Dante quote is that he moves through these four stages in that quotation incredibly quickly. And that's not an accident. I think it's very hard to motivate four stage four, or even stage three, without some dialectical ascent to that position. So we start with something fairly naive and straightforward about the concept. We start pressuring it, so we're somewhere in stage one or two. Then we turn into a stage three thing where there's a common object. Then we get worried about the common object. Then we're at stage four. You have something that I've tried to slow down for you quite a bit, collapse very quickly in the motivation of what perspectivism is. And that's why it's not a view. It's being stated there. He states it as if this were a doctrine, and it all belonged to a single doctrine. But the things he's saying, I think, are not combinable in a single doctrine. They're actually bits of very different doctrines that tend to collapse into each other. I think this is sort of inchoately felt by commentators on Nietzsche. And I think this matters because I think Nietzsche's own later views about this is one in which he's very interested in doing what he calls genealogy, that is an excavation of the structure of the dialectic, and trying to understand how we arrive at such a position. So it's precisely understanding how things that appear to all be parts of a single way of thinking but aren't, but unfold into each other. It's of the essence of Nietzsche's later way of trying to exorcise certain philosophical problems. So if what I'm doing hasn't involved much mention of Nietzsche, I should say it's deeply informed by the reading of later Nietzsche. I also just gave you an entry from a Simon Blackburn dictionary. You can see again it's kind of waffling around about what kind of perspectivism it wants in the light of my distinctions. Quotation 17 is a sort of typical statement of stage three early Nietzschean perspectivism. What you see there at the end of that quotation is the idea of a true estimation, something that belonged to the original metaphor, the original concept. Or as Nietzsche puts it, the adequate expression of an object and the subject. That's come to seem to him, by the time he's reached stage three, to be, as he puts it, ein Widerspruch von des Undings. It seems to be a contradiction in terms. A contradictory non-thing, I guess, would be a literal translation. So, our concepts, any way of thinking, any way of perceiving, is always a function of our perspective. So how could the way things appear itself be a correct expression of the thing? The very possibility of conceptual or perceptual encounter seems to involve perspectival, shall we say, contamination from Nietzsche's point of view. And what I tried to give you in 18 is a kind of argument form I think you can see come up over and over again in Nietzsche. Nietzsche never gives you the argument form in this schematic way. What he does, I think, in his early writings is he just instantiates it with many examples. One example is how the bird or the bee sees the thing, as opposed to the humans. Another example is how we, as opposed to the ancient Greeks, as opposed to the Hindus, see the thing. Another thing is an example of something appearing blue versus green. another example. This is an example of how we use these concepts rather than those concepts. Another example, which we'll look at in a moment, is the fact that we use concepts at all. But in each case, the example is supposed to be an example of how our encounter with the thing reflects our forms of subjectivity. And then it just instantiates this argument for it and draws this conclusion over and over again, depending upon the example it uses. This business about concepts, I think, is kind of interesting because it involves an extra step, which Nietzsche starts worrying about later. It's worth kind of highlighting. And it's also connected to a, I think, really bad reading of Kant, which is incredibly, for reasons I don't understand, became just incredibly institutionalized in the German-speaking world. And it remains quite influential through the Frankfurt School and people like Adorno and so forth, who are really enamored with this reading. But the idea is that the very employment of concepts involves a falsification of reality. So it's not just the idea that our concepts are a function of our perspective, but it's the further idea that any concepts involve generality. And a thing is always particular. And so what we do when we arrive at a concept is we leave out the details. So Nietzsche has this example he really likes that keeps coming up and have it in quotation 19 of a leaf. Each leaf is different. Each leaf has its own personality. Yeah. If leaves don't speak to you, try snowflakes or something else, you know, or fingerprints. You know. But each one is in some way different. But now before the concept leaf, or the concept snowflake, for the concept fingerprint. And we leave out all of those differences. So it looks like what you're doing when you're forming a concept is leaving out a lot of detail and saying something false. Because you're not saying all these. Because what? It's a little hard to say, make exactly clear what the problem is here, but the idea is you've engaged in misrepresentation by engaging in abstraction. So the very ascendancy to concepts involves